G'day everybody, my name is Glenn Hill.
Jacob Meyer.
Welcome to the Tactical Tennis Podcast. And today we're going to talk about the World Tour Finals for the ATP, which just wrapped up over the weekend.
It was a pretty great tournament as far as I was concerned, but lots of people had a lot to say about it.
I think it was a great tournament, and I think it was a great tournament, especially considering how many big names were missing from the tournament. You know, Wawrinka's not there, Murray's not there. Nadal pulls out after one match. Obviously, Djokovic isn't there. But there was a lot of really high-quality tennis. I thought it was very entertaining. And the match that we're going to talk about most tonight, the final, I thought was a great affair. Thoroughly enjoyed that. And I think we're going to spend most of the time tonight talking about that because there's a lot to talk about. It was a very eventful match. A lot of things happened.
A lot of people really assume that with those some of those bigger names out, like, I don't know, I guess that there's just nothing going on or that it's just not good tennis. And it couldn't be farther from the truth. I mean, I think we saw some of the most interesting dynamics that we've seen all year in this last week, and largely in part because there were so many guys that were out.
Yeah, I think so. You know, the round robin format has a massive impact on that as well, because you don't normally play somebody twice in the same tournament or the same event, certainly not in singles. And I think that in this instance, that made for some very interesting dynamics. So if we take the final, for example, where Dimitrov played Goffin, this was the second time they played in a handful of days. And, you know, the first time they played, Dimitrov just destroyed Goffin, 6-love, 6-2. And then they turn around and play a few days later, and Goffin doesn't just take a set, he almost takes the match. And there's a lot of changes that came about as a result of that first match that they played. And so it's really interesting to me. I think it shows just how dynamic of a sport tennis is. I think it also shows how much people can play differently from day to day. And there's a degree to which, obviously, your quality play is impacted by your opponent. And then also just the fact that people aren't robots and they will go out there and have good days and bad days. And that'll impact things as well. So, you know, if we just kind of have a quick overview of the tournament itself, I mean, I think if we talk about surprising results, I mean, I guess we would say Federer's loss in the semifinals to Goffin was surprising. I mean, he took the first set 6-2 and looked in complete control of the match, and then just kind of fell off the wayside.
Yeah, I mean, just nobody called that. I mean, I think with the year that Fed has had. Everyone, or at least, I mean, not everyone, but certainly all the Fed fans. And then, I mean, I was expecting him to at least make it to the final. I mean, wasn't expecting him to get knocked out.
You know, to my mind, I don't think has he lost a match this year when he's been healthy? I'm not sure that he has. And, you know, I certainly expected that the way things were headed, it looked likely that he would take the whole event. But I will say there were some signs from fairly early on in the tournament that things weren't quite right with Fed. I'm not saying that he was hurt, but he just seemed a little out of sorts. You know, if four of the matches, or was it three out of the four matches he played, went three sets. He seemed to kind of be very up and down throughout the tournament. So, I mean, like, if you take his match with Cilic, he loses the first set to breaker and then takes it 6-4, 6-1. Another 6-1 third set victory over Zverev. You know, his match with Sok was a cagey affair. And then again, the match with Goffin, but he just seemed a little off all week. He seemed irritable. He seemed to lose his momentum a little bit, kind of lose focus here and there. And so I don't think it was shocking when he went out, but I still was surprised. I kind of felt after he took that first set 6-2 against Goffin that he would roll that home.
Yeah, look, there are the number of times that Fed loses when he wins the first set indoors is extremely small over the whole course of his career, and it's been 3 or 4 years since that's happened. And the last time it happened, I think, was to Djokovic. It's not like, I mean, people just weren't saying like, yeah, oh, okay, Fed won the first set. And here we go, Goffin, he's probably going to come back and beat him. Like, that's not...
Right. Once Fed gets the lead indoors, it's usually a done deal. So, I mean, but I think from the early matches, at least, if Dimitrov looked good money to make the finals to me, the way that he'd been playing. I think the only person that really looked like they might be a threat to him is Fed because of the matchup and the history there. But, you know, he stormed through to the finals.
Well, right? I didn't think. I mean, look, credit to you because you've been preaching about Dimitrov's number all year long, going all the way back to Brisbane.
Right, I kept the faith even through the clay court season, which was a little less than stellar for Grigor.
No, people definitely been looking at you like, dude, you got to be kidding me. Grigor's not looking good.
But he's finishing the year ranked three after this,
which is wild. And you know, everyone's going to say, well, yeah, but you know, Djokovic took the year off, and you know, Andy's out, and Stan had surgery, and it's like, yeah, like I understand that we didn't predict, you know, all these guys were going to get hurt. But I mean, that's part of the game, and, you know.
And we have also been talking about the fact that Djokovic has been in a bit of trouble for a while.
We did make predictions about him. We certainly didn't see Stan coming. I don't think either one of us. Nishikori, you've always thought, you know, has hardly had a full season ever, so that's no surprise.
Yeah, no shock there. But, I mean, honestly, look, the way Grigor played, when he played well on the hard courts, I think he was going to finish probably around five-ish, regardless of who was hurt and who wasn't.
I'm just saying that was you. I certainly was not in that boat, so you get credit for that because I don't think it was a no-brainer. And I certainly didn't have...
Thanks.
I didn't have Grigor going to the final, and I didn't have him winning it. Even when he went to the final, I thought, oh, man, you know, it's hard to beat the same guy twice in a row, especially when he's, you know, top 10 in the world, and... you've just had a very easy match against him. I think the normal intuition is like, oh, you just beat him easily. Okay, you're going to beat him again. But that's not really the way it works. The psychology comes into play on the tour. And it's almost like it's too easy for the guy that wins. And the guy that just got his, you know, well, he just got beat down, basically, has everything to prove. He has nothing to lose. He's just...
And also is in a great position to make adjustments because he's come out with a plan that he knew didn't work, and the other guy had a plan that he knew did work. The guy who had the working plan now basically has to react to the changes that he knows are probably coming at him, but he doesn't know what they're going to look like necessarily. And so there's a part where, you know, when you win that first match, you don't have the initiative for the second match because you know the guy's probably going to come out with a new game plan. And you don't know what it's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a tough thing. You see it especially outside of the top 10 with guys that play twice in a row. It's very, very often back and forth, 50-50. So anyway, I'm just saying, look, like it's easy for you to say, well, Dimitrov was in good form. It looked like he was going to the final. But frankly, I think most of the tennis world did not have Dimitrov going to the final. So kudos to you on that. But
thanks.
More importantly, no, just kidding. But, in all seriousness, I mean, if we look at the rest of the way that the draw shook down, I mean, I thought, okay, Rafa showed up, he's playing, he's going to continue to play. I was obviously surprised, just like everyone else, when Goffin beat Rafa. But then when he pulled out is when I thought, okay, you know, now Grigor really has a shot. I mean, I didn't think that he was going to get through Rafa. I didn't think he was going to get through Fed. So I thought, no way is Grigor going to actually lift this trophy. But, hey, he didn't lose a match. I mean, he only lost, what, two sets in the whole tournament, I think?
Might have been three in total. You know, the two blowout sets that he had, blowout wins that he had, kind of, I think, skewed the perception a little bit. But, you know, I felt like he would have got through Rafa on the indoor hards the way that he was playing. I feel like Fed presents a very different matchup for him. But, you know, let's talk a little bit about this final because it came, obviously, a few days after they had already played. And as I said earlier, in the first match, Dimitrov just ran away with it. It wasn't really competitive. But I thought there was a few interesting things. So one of the things that Grigor had done a great job of all week was using the slice backhand to control play. And so he had two patterns that he used a lot, and they both were based off of the cross-court slice, where he would play the cross-court slice and then either run around that next ball and set up for an inside-out or inside-in forehand, or then proceed to play the next slice backhand short down the line and force his opponent to get on the run and open up the court for a forehand on the next ball.
See, it's interesting that you put it that way, because I really think of that slice down the line as being the one that really makes your point. I think of the cross-court slice as being almost like a neutral ball. I mean, he runs around every backhand. Like, he's running.
Right. No, but he's using the slice to set that up.
Well, how does it set it up?
When he's playing the good cross-court slice, I mean, the ball's low, so it's harder for people to attack with pace. Guys will tend to take that up a little bit higher on the reply if they hit over it. If they don't hit over it, you know, he's already setting up. Look, I guess that's a bigger question in a sense. It's hard to take a low cross-court slice and redirect it up the line.
Yeah.
So when he hits that cross-court slice in, cross-court, and keeps it low, he knows the ball down the line ball is relatively safe. And to my money right now, Grigor probably has the best on-the-run forehand in the game. Like, he defends the forehand side better than anybody right now.
Come on.
I think so.
Delpo?
I think so. No, I think Grigor moves better.
For sure he moves than Delpo. Better.
Well, that's part of it. I say he defends better to the forehand side. If you want to tell me movement's not a part of defending, then, you know,
no, I
probably need to start recording and hash that out. But I think he defends better on the forehand side than anybody.
Shame on
right
you.
Now.
Logic is way too good to make that comment on a podcast. No.
So
look, this is pretty clear to me. Okay, with what you're saying, it's not that you're wrong about what you're saying about the cross-court slice. But it's pretty simple in the sense that there's really only two things that I think are directly relevant to the point that you're making. One is that when you hit a good cross-court slice, the ball is low, people feel like it's hard to attack. So they have a tendency to overcompensate or make maybe an inaccurate adjustment, and they hit the ball higher, they hit it slower, they hit it maybe, you want to say maybe spinnier, but it's really that they're hitting slower. And they're probably not
right, but I,
angle.
But I,
and then the other big factor is that, because you touched on those, the big factor is that it just gives him more time, because not only is his opponent hitting a slower shot, but the slice itself is a slower shot. So he has more time to run around his backhand the same way he would run around any other backhand. But he's got more time.
Right, but I think it's important to note that because taking that slice down the line is harder, more difficult, he'll not recover as far towards center. He's setting up for that forehand with more confidence. He's leaving that line more open. Whereas I think when he hits over because the ball sits up that little bit more, you know, he has to gauge the quality of shot a little better in order to make that positioning adjustment to set up for that forehand. So, you know, he used that to good effect throughout the whole tournament. What was very interesting to me was right at the very beginning of this match in the final, we saw Goffin, some of the adjustments that Goffin was going to make, like in the first couple of points, because, you know, at the very first service game, like Dimitrov's in the first service game of the match, he plays that cross-court slice, and Goffin committed early to run around it and played the forehand inside in for a clean winner.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened, I want to say it was either the first, second point of the match. I want to say it was the first point of the match. And the moment I saw that, I literally sat up. I was in the hotel room, and I sat up. I was like, oh, hello. This is going to be an interesting match. Mm-hmm. Which was funny, a reaction to have after one point. But, lo and behold, he gets his first break point, and exactly the same thing plays out. Dimitrov plays the slice cross court. Goffin committed, ran around, and played the inside in forehand. It would have been a winner, but it clipped the top of the tape and sat up. Dimitrov ended up winning that point, but Goffin got the break in the end. But the point was, like, he served notice from the very beginning that he was aware of the pattern that Dimitrov was using, and he was going to break that pattern. Mm-hmm. So that was, to me, a very fascinating insight into the types of adjustments that players can make from previous experience, especially recent previous experience playing an opponent, where I think if they'd played 2 months apart, Goffin might not have made that adjustment. Hmm. You know, that very clear, like, pattern level adjustment This wasn't like it just a, oh, I'm going to play his backhand more kind of thing. He was expecting a specific shot in a specific situation, and he had a plan for how to deal
with it. I think the cool thing is, if Goffin had lost that first match 6-6, how much would he have changed?
Probably not as much as he did.
Or but hardly anything. But you know, since it was a blowout, he came in with, okay, I need a totally different plan.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think his energy level and commitment were a part of that plan. There's, I think, a level to where that first match, he just didn't show up to play. And I think you'd mentioned this when we spoke earlier, that he alluded to this in an interview that was in French, where
he was not feeling, I mean, he was just like, look, his motivation was struggling. He wasn't all there. He was feeling bad for himself because of other matches and stuff.
Right. So let's talk about one of the other big adjustments that Goffin made that I'm sure you noticed. I know that I noticed it. And he made this throughout the tournament, which was to do with his positioning.
So what did you see?
Well, what I saw, which I loved, by the way, I'm a huge fan of Goffin doing this, was Goffin making a concerted effort to move forward and meet the ball. He actively tried to take time away from his opponents, catch the ball inside the baseline where possible, and oftentimes he would retreat back after the shot to a more neutral position a couple of feet behind the baseline, but he very continuously moved in to try and take time away. And that was, to me, a very obvious adjustment to the surface, and I think it paid great dividends, and I loved the fact that he came out with that mentality. It was shades of Davidenko and Agassi.
He looked actually, you know, it's funny, this is the first time you've said that, but people have compared him to Davidenko, like the commentators compared him to Davidenko, I think largely because of his stature and because he's very equally balanced in the sense that his forehand and backhand are similar strengths. Like he's not one of these guys like Dimitrov has an obviously better forehand. He's got, you know, his backhand's good, but his forehand's obviously better. And Goffin's not like that. Like he hurts you probably more, like he finishes more probably with the forehand, but people think of like his backhand down the line as being a better shot. People think of his backhand return as being a better shot. You know, it depends a little bit on how you play, what you perceive to be really good about his game, because he's kind of hurting you in a lot of different places. But when you said Agassi, I just thought, like, I had flashbacks to the patterns where it was a little bit, maybe not early in Agassi's career, but maybe midway through, before he got super disciplined and had that sense of clarity with how he was trying to play, where it was like, good cross-court ball, and then like he probably should hit another good cross-court ball, but he just hits the snot out of the ball straight ahead instead. And that was golfing to me to a T in this match. Like, he almost was all over the patterns. He was timing the ball great. He's hitting the ball great. He almost had enough to actually take this one from Dimitrov, but I feel like he wasn't quite clear enough on what he needed to do.
So you're suggesting that when you say that, okay, so you know, we have access to some pretty good data here on the match, and I find that comment interesting, and I think there's some information in the actual data that backs that up. So interestingly, so when we look at Goffin's forehands, right, he only put 7% of his forehands in the middle of the court in terms of side to side laterally, right? If we split the court into three zones, he's playing basically a half of them into Dimitrov's forehand, almost half, 43% into Dimitrov's backhand, and about 7% up the middle. And I think we could probably safe to say that ones that he hit up the middle were more reactionary, maybe defensive shots. Those were probably the balls that were hit with less intent or less control. But there's a very clear pattern. I mean, like, there's a gap up the middle of the court. That's far more obvious than Dimitrov. Like, Dimitrov had a much more even spread, comparatively speaking. But when we look at Goffin's backhand, he only took about 14% up the line, but he did hang about 20% of them in the center of the court. Mm-hmm. And again, a degree of that's probably Dimitrov attacking him and him maybe trying to get a ball cross court and not quite getting it there because he's late or rushed or, you know, overpowered a little bit. But I would suggest that probably if you're hitting 14% of your backhands up the line and you're goofing, there might be a problem.
And what specifically is the problem?
Well, when I put all the data together, I say specifically the problem is that only 66% of your backhands are going cross-court, actually cross-court.
You think it should be more?
I think for Goffin, that number should be higher. I think he's fine splitting the numbers the way he did off the forehand side, but off the backhand, I think in this matchup especially, that's where he's going to be able to have a better impact. I think backhand to backhand, he can step inside the court, take the ball earlier than Dimitrov can, and play him out of position there.
So,
that's, you know, coming back to like that recent article, that's the matchup that he wants to win. He needs to work that matchup and take it.
So we're looking at the same Hawkeye data here. So we can see,
yes,
you know, we're in different places. We're on different sides of the country. But we're looking at the same data, and we can see where each ball lands, okay, so that this makes sense, so you guys understand what we're looking at. So if you compare where Goffin's forehands land to where his backhands land, his forehands spread the court more. Like, they're just better placed. They're closer to the lines. They're farther away from the middle of the court. When you look at his backhands, two-thirds of his backhands make it cross-court, but really, how many of his backhands are within a meter of the doubles alley?
Yeah, not very many. And that's interesting to me, is a lot of these backhands that are technically cross-court are balls that Dimitrov could comfortably run around.
Right.
And hit forehands.
And that's really the trouble to me. So, like, one of the things that I think Goffin didn't do well enough in this match is stay... I mean, basically, he, in my mind, how I actually think about it is he did not play enough like Davidenko.
Yeah, he didn't stay on task.
Yeah,
to me, you know, like he came off that matchup that he wanted too early, too often. And the thing is, like, he won the positioning battle. You know, I mean, if we look at where they're making contact with the ball, he won the positioning battle. He hit more, significantly more balls inside the baseline than Dimitrov did. You know, and then if we look at the absolute deepest zone in the court, like, he hit. Dimitrov literally hit 30% of his shots from deep in the court to Goffin's 20%. I mean, he won the position battle in that regard. The problem is that I think too often when he's hitting the hit 27% inside the baseline, too many of those 27% weren't to the right place.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
you know,
to me, we talked about this beforehand. This is where I feel like Goffin was really pressing himself to play, to make decisions and almost play a style of tennis that he's really not quite comfortable with. Like, he's not Davidenko. Davidenko was like a machine in the sense
that, I mean, Davidenko built his game to play that way.
Yeah, well, I mean,
he committed to it on all surfaces.
It's not like Davidenko couldn't hit the ball down the line. Like, he just...
Well, he did a
lot. Just felt very strongly that he knew how he wanted to play, and he might have to hit five cross-court backhands to either hit a good enough one to hurt someone or to open up the court enough so that when he went down the line, he was really either winning the point or ahead in the point.
Well, so I'm going to break in there for 1 second, though, because I think Davidenko actually hit a fairly large number of backhands down the line. But the difference to me is when we look at this match and Goffin's playing 27% of his shots inside the baseline, 53% of them in this zone kind of, you know, from the baseline to about four feet back, and then 20% behind that. If we look at Davidenko's numbers, he's going to have significantly higher percentage inside the baseline, and a lot of his hip positions are going to be right around the baseline, like clustered a lot more tightly. Goffin's giving up still too much ground. So when Davidenko took that backhand down the line, even if the shot quality wasn't the greatest, he was just rushing you all the time on it, which makes a big difference.
He was hurting you a little bit more.
Yeah, because Davydenko's standing on the baseline and moving inside the baseline to hit that backhand, whereas Goffin's starting 2 or 3 feet behind the baseline and then moving to just inside the baseline to hit his backhand. And that's, you know, that's a big difference. The thing to me is, like, if I catch the ball 2 feet higher up in the court, the ball's traveling 4 feet less when you count how far it's actually traveling on my side of the court.
Right, it doubles.
You know, every foot higher I go, it doubles. Yeah. And so, you know, just being a couple of feet higher up makes a big difference. I mean, cumulatively, that makes a huge difference.
Goffin's really 2 meters behind the baseline. And then, like, standing in tight for Goffin is being a meter behind the baseline. And, you know, Davydenko was more of like a, you know, toes on the baseline kind of guy. So he's taking the ball 6-8 feet closer, or, you know, 6-8 feet less travel time than what Goffin is. But, the thing to me is I just think that, like, Davydenko built his game, like you said, to play a certain way, where it seems like Goffin really is a spectacular player. Like, he can do everything. He's got a great forehand. He's got a great backhand. He's got great returns off both sides. He's more than competent at the net. He's actually got a very good serve for a guy his size. He hits his spots incredibly well. Like, when you look at the data and compare him to Dimitrov, he hits his spots better than Dimitrov does on the serve. He's closer to the lines. He's more consistent. The balls are more bunched. But he doesn't have as much as Davydenko did, that absolute clarity of, okay, this is exactly how I'm going to play. It's more like he runs around counter-punching.
Yeah, I mean, Davydenko certainly had a conviction with the way that he came out in the court. And I think Goffin doesn't have that yet. But I think he's figured a lot of things out. And look, I'm not actually faulting what he did. I think he played a great tournament. I think if he served better, he probably wins that match. Unfortunately for him, he had a very poor serving day. I mean, he was 49% first serves on the match. And that's just not good enough. Like, you can't serve 49% and not have more of them come out. Or if you do, you've got to be winning more of your second
serves. Well, the thing that's wild is he was 42% first serves in the first set, and he had chances to win that first set. Like, I think if you went
to
that
set... But I'll also say, that was... I agree, but that was also Grigor's worst serving set of the match as well. And that was the thing to me. Like, they both came out... That first... Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying. But the flip side of that too, though, is, yes... Actually, I'm sorry. I read that the stats are flipped. He actually, Grigor was at 69% the first set.
Oh, yeah. But
the thing is, Grigor also hit three doubles in that first set, which was important. And then also, very, very importantly to me, like, Grigor's second serve in that first set was horrendous. He had toss issues early on in that match. That was one of the things I wanted to talk about, was Grigor came out not serving well at all. His toss was a little wayward. Like, it was a little too far off to his left, posterior, if we want to get really technical about it. And, you know, that he was off balance a lot of the time. So, I mean, he threw in more doubles. He was only winning 25% of his second serve points in that first set. And that's nowhere near good enough. I mean, like, he's above 50% for
the fact
year,
that he won
on all surfaces.
The fact that he won a set winning 25% of second serves in the World Tour Finals is outrageous.
Well, but here's the trick is, Goffin only won 31% of his second serves, and Goffin had to hit more second serves. And that's the difference at the end of the day in that first set. That's all it really was. And that's why I say, if Goffin had a better serving day, then I think he wins that match. But unfortunately, he didn't. And this is one of the problems. When you're 5'11", and you're going to come out and serve for aces, which Goffin is doing, make no mistake. If you look at his serving chart, I mean, he's putting a lot of balls right near lines. And he does not hit it. He doesn't hit it. Goffin literally doesn't hit a single body serve for a first serve the entire match. Nope. He's serving for aces on first serves at every serve.
Yeah.
And you know, that doesn't leave you a lot of margin when you're 5'11". And that's the difference. You know, that's a big, big part of the difference. I mean, his groupings, the serves that he makes, his groupings are tighter than Dimitrov's. Absolutely no doubt about it. But the problem is that they're serving the same average first serve speed, and Goffin's 4 inches shorter. and that's where you go from, you know, being Grigor and having 65% first serves of the match, and being Goffin and having 49%.
Well, and I think, yeah, I mean, I think he just missed some of it. I don't know what caused him to serve 49%. I think both of the guys had a little bit of nerves starting out. I mean, those first couple of games, I mean, the first four games, I think, were breaks.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think that was a very cagey first set from both of them. But part of that to me comes back to what we were talking about earlier with these tactical adjustments. Like, there's a little bit of uncertainty for both of them because, look, Grigor kind of has an idea of what he wants to do because he's been doing it all week. And the trick is, like, he knows Goffin's going to come out and try and do something different, or at least he strongly suspects that he is. But he doesn't know what it's going to be. So that gives him that little sense of uncertainty, and Goffin does come out doing different stuff, and that's going to take Grigor a little while to kind of acclimatize to and get used to. But if we look at it from Goffin's side of things, he's going to come out with a plan, but he doesn't know whether or not his plan's going to work. And then he's also trying to implement this plan. And look, I mean, obviously, they're playing an actual match. Like, this isn't a simulation. Goffin's out there trying to implement this plan that Dimitrov's trying to not let him implement. So, you come out there with the uncertainty of, is this the right plan? Do I need to stick with this the whole match? What do I need to do to make it work? And so, for both of them, there was very much this feeling out period early in the match. Not that they were playing tentative tennis, mind you. I think they both came out and played aggressively and tried to do productive things with the ball.
Yeah, they're.
But it was cagey in the sense of both having a little, some doubt as to how things were going to play out. And yeah, I think that resulted in that first set being a very kind of cagey affair where they were both a little, missing a few balls and maybe not playing as well as they might. And obviously the nerves as well. I mean, this is a big occasion. They're both had a lot on the line for them. A lot of money, a lot of points.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, Dimitrov was going to be number three no matter what, but Goffin planned to be
Right.
top 10 for the first time. I mean, this is the biggest title of their career. I mean, there's just so much. Like, there's a few things that really stood out to me. I mean, for Goffin to come out and play the final essentially with a new game plan. I mean, I've never seen him play a match this aggressive.
Well, I'll tell you, he did. I know you didn't get to catch as much because you were traveling and whatnot. But he did play fairly high up in the court the whole tournament. This to me was very much a strategy that he came in wanting to
Well,
use.
he yeah, but he's way higher up in the court, even from the first time he played Dimitrov in that tournament to the second.
Well, against Dimitrov, yes, but I think also, I would just say to please keep in mind that this was not the first match that he played Dimitrov. It was not exactly he wasn't there. I mean, he admitted himself. When you look at his match against Thiem, for example, his breakdowns are almost exactly the same in terms of his contact point on the court.
Got to pick somebody besides team because teams, playing from the stands,
Well,
begging
I'm working on it.
you.
I'm working
No,
on it.
so this actually is interesting to me because the other thing that stood out is the next closest match that Dimitrov had in the tournament was with team, which is a little bit surprising to me because Goffin's strategy to beat Dimitrov was, press forward and attack from inside the baseline with his ground strokes and finish at the net and finish forward. But really it's, he's really beating you with just inside the baseline ground strokes. Thiem, on the other hand, is 3, 4, 5 meters behind the baseline. And his strategy was, I'm just going to beat you from really far back. And
But that didn't
it didn't
work.
work for either one of them. Neither one of them were able to pull him off, but they both got very close. It's really interesting that such polar opposite strategies could both become very, very close to actually working.
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, I think part of that's, matchup stuff. But I just want to come back to this really quickly about TM having, not TM, sorry, Goffin having this as a strategy for the entire tournament, right? So when I said his numbers were basically identical against TM as they against TM as they were against Dimitrov, when we look at his match against Nadal, he actually hits even more shots inside the baseline against Nadal than he does against either TM or Dimitrov. And Ironically, he actually hits a few more behind in the deepest zone as well. But that, you know, you're playing Rafa. That's to be understood. Here's the other fascinating thing. His highest number inside the baseline for the entire tournament was against Federer in the semi that he won. And that's where he actually hit the fewest balls from the deepest position. Like, to me, I thought he made a very concerted effort to do this the entire tournament.
He did. I just felt like
for him to be better at it. Yeah, see, I don't see that from the data. Sorry, go ahead.
Do you think? Well, I'm going not as much from the data, but from the sense that I had from watching the pieces and the bits of the matches that I got to watch. And I didn't sit and watch every match end to end. So we both know that I could totally be wrong on this.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I should say this, actually. The deepest he played, Goffin played the entire tournament, was in his first match against Dimitrov.
Right.
That was the deepest he played the entire tournament. And so that, to me, was telling about where he was mentally in that match. But, you know, when I look at his positioning, his average court positioning, and how many balls he's hitting inside the baseline, and it's important when we look at the balls inside the baseline to kind of discard a little bit the ones that are hit from really, really short, because those are not necessarily by choice, or, you know, they're balls, not balls that you have an option to not hit inside the baseline. Mm-hmm. But there's no doubt looking at this that he's pushing up. And the further into the tournament he got, the further he started pushing up. So, you know, what you want to make of that, I don't know. But
yeah, no, it just seemed like the further he went into the tournament, the more committed he was to really pressing his game and attacking. And I just think that it's commendable to do that in the tour finals.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I just don't think that it's easy to overstate how rare this is for someone to really stand up and say, okay, I'm going to go out and take this thing. And to do it in a way where it's not like he's doing what team's doing, where he's like, okay, I'm going to hit the ball harder. Or like what Stan did when he was at the French, where he was like, I'm just going to rope every ball as hard as I possibly can. But he's got tons of time. He's way back behind the baseline. All he's talking about is like a different focus and a different, maybe like trying to get another 1% out of his effort level. Goffin's saying like, I'm going to move in way closer than what I actually have been comfortable playing in my career. I'm going to give myself less time to react and hit the ball, and less time to make decisions and really press and do things that really are making him uncomfortable. Like, he's uncomfortable. He would love to just run around 2 meters behind the baseline and counterpunch. He could do that forever. But I think he's not going to beat Dimitrov doing that.
Right. Well, I think he's not going to beat a lot of guys, of the top guys, doing that. You know, there's a part too where I question how uncomfortable this really is for him. You know, when I go back and look, so I just pulled out some data from, I'm going back a little ways here, but from him playing Kyrgios early this year in Miami, you know, he's actually pressing up a fair bit in that match as well. I was trying to, I kind of skipped past the clay court season because obviously that changes people's positioning a little bit. But, you know, there's a part where I think one of the things that you mentioned earlier about how Goffin has a very balanced game,
mm-hmm.
and he does a lot of things quite well, is that I think he is thinking out there and he is making adjustments from surface to surface. And this is one of these adjustments that he's been working with for a while. I just think that at the World Tour Finals, he pushed it a little more strongly, and it was a little more evident that, you know, he was committed to doing this start to finish as a primary strategy. You know, he looked like he really was actively trying to take time away.
Yeah.
But I don't know that this is new.
Well, it's not completely new, and it's unrealistic to think that somebody's going to go out there in the Tour Finals and do something like for the first time. He clearly thinks that this is his ticket to playing his best tennis. He's been working on it. It's just, you know, it's like pulling teeth to get these guys to get that far out of their comfort zone and to do it in the biggest matches of his life. I mean, it says something very good about where Goffin might be able to take his game. I mean, he believes that he can beat anybody, and he believes that he's a top five guy, or that at least that he can be a top five guy.
Look, I think if he stays healthy next year, he has a great shot at it.
Yeah.
You know, I think he really, really does. From what I've seen of him this year, you know, he's had some terrible luck with the injuries and tops.
Yeah, he took a bad fall on the clay, if you're not aware of that, which, like, he slipped on the, like, tarp that usually isn't even on a court, but they had a tarp at the very back of a clay court. And just, I mean, to point out, that's how far back this guy likes to play. That he's basically...
Well, on the clay, yeah.
He was basically back on a part of the court that isn't even part of the court. And he slipped and he had like a really bad ankle injury. And so he was out for a while. But I mean, he's had an exceptional year. He was on your radar way, way earlier in the year because he was...
But I want to point out, just I need to take this moment to say that, I mean, this is a headline you'll never see again in tennis, I hope. But this was an actual headline from the incident, was David Goffin's injury prompts tarp debate among players at French Open. So,
yeah, well, I think they're probably.
I don't think we've had a lot of tarp debates. Yeah, I would. I mean, I imagine after that, probably so. But you know, I mean, that had a huge impact on his year as a whole. But you know, hopefully, he'll be able to stay healthy next year. No more. You know, he to me isn't one of these guys that's injury prone. That was kind of a very special circumstance. You know, we obviously don't like to see happen to anybody. But, you know, if we look ahead to next year, the Australian Open's going to be very, very interesting. But what do you see for Dimitrov if we look, you know, like over the course of 2018, given what Dimitrov's done in this last part of the year and the first part of the year too, last year, this year, it's still this year, what do you see for Dimitrov in 2018?
I mean, this is really tough because I still see the holes in Dimitrov's game as being... Well, I mean, frankly, they bother me on a personal level. I mean, I'm not gonna BS about what this is. Like, I recognize how tough he is to beat as a player. To me, he has some of the greatest gifts of any of the guys on the tour. Like, he's very athletic in a way that he was basically born, and he works.
I think he's phenomenally athletic. Yeah. And we saw stages in the... I mean, I'm sure people who watched that match will know the point that I'm talking about, where Goffin played the inside-out slice backhand, and Dimitrov ran around there and hooked that forehand to the court and then closed for the volley. I mean, that was athleticism at a level we normally see from, like, Federer and maybe one or two other guys. I mean, it was a phenomenally athletic point.
Yeah. I mean, look, he's just... Like... I think Gregor works hard. He's very strong. He's very explosive. He's very athletic. So hard work for him, in a sense, is easier than it is for some of the other guys. But like, you could not convince me that he's the hardest working guy on the tour. He's by no means lazy. He's not the laziest guy on the tour. I'm not trying to make any kind of ridiculous thing. I'm just saying, like, he's not the hardest working guy on the tour, and he is absolutely one of the most athletic guys on the tour. So to me, that's a gift. And I just, there's just a lot that is left to be desired in his game. But what I see moving forward is I think he's going to take a lot of confidence from this in a way that really matters, because I actually think that a lot of the work that he's done over the years has been misplaced. I think that he's worked a lot on just working, and I don't think he's worked enough specifically, like, for instance, on patterns. I think he's worked too generally, too abstractly about, like, you know, like, he's worked very hard to try and run around backhands, trying to find your forehand, so to say. Sometimes coaches will say something like that, like, you know, make it a forehand, find your forehand, like, your forehand's your weapon, or whatever it is. He's worked very hard at that, but we've never seen him use slice intelligently like he is right now. Like, it's not that complicated to say, hey, hit a short angle cross court slice and then hit the next one down the line and short. And guess what? You're going to hit a forehand on the next ball. Like, there's...
Well, we saw this in Brisbane. Like, that was one of the things that I noted at the very beginning of the year. When he won Brisbane, that was when I started saying, look, people, you need to pay attention because this is going to be his breakout year, because it was the first time that I saw him playing with that kind of intelligence.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, like, I still don't think... I mean, so of course you didn't ask about this, but I don't think that he's got it all together on the clay.
No, I don't think he's got it all together.
But when it comes to the beginning of the year in Australia, I think that everything suits him there. His athleticism is a big advantage. It's hot. He's not going to get tired. It's not going to bother him. The ball's flying. Conditions are a little bit funny in Brisbane. I wouldn't be surprised if he goes back there. But the biggest thing to me is just that I think he has more clarity of purpose. And I think that really matters for a guy like him. Instead of just running around and reacting to everything, I think he's playing with a purpose, in the sense that instead of reacting to stuff, he's making things happen. And he's just a much, much more difficult player to beat that way. And he's much, much less likely to give away games when he's trying to make things happen, especially give away his own service games. Like, he has a long history of just playing like kind of pointless service games where he gets broken, where he just make a bad error, or he just doesn't do anything. And when he's passive, like, he's not Roger Federer. Like, when Roger Federer is passive, he still is aggressive. Like, he still opens up the court. Like, he's still hurt.
Would you say he's passive aggressive?
Yeah. I was waiting for that.
I couldn't resist. You just like, that was softball.
Because I don't know how else to say it. I mean, it's a weird thing.
You put that, like, on a stick for me to hear.
Roger doesn't know how to play tennis without attacking something. Even with his slice backhand, he moves you around the court. You know, he doesn't even, like, you don't see Federer, like, chip backhands up the middle of the court that sit up high. Like, it's always like a short angle, uncomfortable, like, do I come in or do I stay back? Like, you know, Grigor's not like that. Like, if Grigor doesn't have purpose, he sprays the ball, or he hits the ball up the middle and he hits it right into your wheelhouse. So it doesn't work out really well for him. And then I think his second serve is a weakness. So, you know, all this stuff combines to, he has to play with purpose. But when he plays with purpose, oh my God, he's a top five player. So,
right.
You know, I think Australia is going to go well for him overall, being those three tournaments. If he plays those three tournaments, I would imagine he's probably only going to play two. But, you know, I think everything has to do with his draw at the Australian Open. There's still guys, you know, that are going to beat him. And it's weird. Like, it used to be he had to avoid guys that are higher ranked. But, I mean, he's number three now. Djokovic is outside of the top 10. Like, if he draws Djokovic, I think he's in big trouble. You know, I mean,
well, I think anybody who draws Djokovic should expect to be in big trouble.
I mean, I think so too.
Kind of Captain Obvious reporting for duty.
Well, it's just, we can't forget about that. So, you know, I'd like to say that he's a guy that's going to make it to the quarters. But it's really just draw dependent.
Right. I mean, I don't know if this is going to be, I haven't checked yet, but I know they did just with, reduce the number of seeds at the Grand Slam from 32 to 16.
But that,
so there's going to be more dangerous floaters around in 2018.
Is that going to be in 2018? I thought that was...
That's why I said I don't know.
Yeah, I think they're talking about doing that, but they haven't done it.
No, it's happened. It's just a question of when it's going to kick in. It's official now, to my understanding. Because Coco Vanderwey had a few things to say about that on Twitter. But anyways... So see, when I look at Dimitrov, I mean, I think that he plays with purpose now. I think he's been playing with purpose all year. The problem is, when he plays on clay, the purpose that he plays with is wrong. He still has to hit over his backhand return a lot more. As long as he chips the way that he chips, he's going to struggle against a lot of players, because people can take initiative away from him that way. And when he loses initiative, he still isn't great at getting it back in the way that, you know, some of these other top guys are. But I do expect him to finish the year top six. I think that the higher seedings going into the slams at the start of the year are going to do well for him. The confidence is going to do well for him. The big things to me is, yeah, I think he's got to work on the serve. I mean, he's got a live arm, and he's clocking that first serve kind of fast, but he doesn't hit spots the way that great servers do. And his second serve, I think, along with that, just isn't where it needs to be. And so, to me, I expect he'll still have good results on hard court next year. I think unless he makes these changes, he's going to struggle on the clay. So, to me, it just comes down to working on the serve and hitting over more backhand returns and just being more aggressive off the return in general. And you know, if he does those things, he'll I think, finish potentially top four. If he doesn't, then I think he'll finish probably top six.
There's, to me, like, he's still well behind Novak. I don't think he's ahead of Andy.
The last I heard, which was as of less than a week ago, Novak still isn't on-court practicing. So I'm not expecting a whole lot for him early in 2018. And I'm expecting, you know, it's going to take him a little while to get things back together. Novak's not a pure talent player in the way some of these guys are in terms of ball striking.
Come on.
He relies... No, come on. I mean,
he was top 20 in the world when he was, like, 19.
Yeah, I know. I know he was. I'm just saying, like, to me, he's a guy that works very hard to get what he
has. He does hit a lot of balls.
I think importantly to me, like, he has to hit a lot of balls. Like, I think that's really important for him to play.
He's very timing based.
Yeah, and that's my point. Like, he's going to come into the season and he's going to be rusty. Like, I just don't think he's going to be able to get the volume working that he needs. So, yeah, I mean, I think Dimitrov could finish top four next year if he makes the adjustments that I'm talking about. The reality is I don't expect him to make, certainly not all of them. I don't expect his serve to improve dramatically going into next year. I don't expect he's going to come out and start hitting over, you know, most of his backhand returns. And so there's a part where, look, I think he'll probably end up somewhere around five or six next year. When we switch gears to Goffin, though, that's an interesting one.
Goffin could end up ahead of Dimitrov next year to me. I mean, he's doing more of the right things. I think Dimitrov has just been... I mean, Dimitrov's been ahead of Goffin, I think, as a player for years. Goffin's really closed the gap. I just... You know, if he's going to be committed to this way of playing, if he plays this way for the next 2 years, I mean, he's going to be a force. Like, he's pushing the evolution of his own game into rare territory. So I just don't know. I mean, we just don't very often see people really develop like that. I mean, Davidenko did.
I didn't really I didn't really feel like I saw Davidenko evolve like that.
You probably don't remember Davidenko when he was like 50 in the world, you know, because he's not on people's radar. I remember when he was like 50 in the world and he held a press conference with his coach after a match and they asked him like what he needed to do to improve. And he was like, well, you know, I need to get my smash better and then I think I'll be top 10. And people were just laughing. Like, who's this guy? You know, this little like 5 foot.
No, I remember that.
You know, and then sure enough, like he got his smash better and his serve got better as a result of the technical work that he did. And the next thing you know, the guy was five in the world. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I mean, where do you think Goffin's going to end up at the end of, say, 2018?
I mean, I think he's going to be a top 10 player. The thing about Goffin to me is there's, like, you know, he has a very nice, solid all-around game. The problem is he doesn't have any overwhelming weapon. Like, you know, when we look at, you know, the differences between Dimitrov and Goffin, I mean, you know, off the ground, Dimitrov's forehand is at another level from anything that Goffin brings to the table. The Dimitrov's a better athlete than Goffin. He's more explosive. The difference is that Goffin, I think, doesn't have some of the weaknesses. He's a better returner. Not quite as good of a server just because these percentages are lower. You know, he hits his spots better, but, I think the difference is that Goffin is going to have more consistent results throughout the year. I think his highs are not going to be as high as Dimitrov's, but his lows aren't going to be as low. Goffin will be a threat on the clay, which Dimitrov I don't expect will be, unless he makes some adjustments, and I'm leaving room for that to happen. You know, I think that Kofin will end up right around that same area, that he'll finish the next year, you know, in that 5 to 7 range. He's going to enter the year ranked 7, which is, you know, his career high. He's been top 10 for a little bit now, but not a long time. And, yeah, I mean, I think that he's going to end up a solid top 10 fixture for the next, you know, 4 or 5 years. Whether or not he can make that next step up, to me, will really purely come down to one question, and that is, how high up in the court is he willing to play? Because if he's going to play deep at all on the hard courts, then I think he's going to tap out around 5 or 6. If he's willing to genuinely step up and start to rub time in the way that Agassi did at his prime when Agassi was playing his best tennis, and the way that Davidenko did when he was playing his best tennis, then I think he could be a top 4 guy. You know, this all depends on some other things too.
I mean, it's just crazy when you look at tennis right now. Like, you're not wrong about Goffin, but if he's able to do that, I mean, look at the names of the guys that are still up there killing themselves all the time.
And some of them are young. I mean, like, Zverev is going to finish the year, what, 4 or 5?
Zverev is finishing at 4. Thiem is finishing at 5. Cilic is coming in at 6. Like, he's still up there. And I think that we both feel like, well, you know, Grigor and Goffin are going to end up ahead of Cilic. But then Stan's coming back. Delpo's on the way back. Delpo's come from no ranking to 11, right?
Yeah. See, but this is the thing. So I look at that, and maybe this is just room for another podcast, and probably we will do one specifically about this. But, I mean, I think both of them are going to end up ranked higher than Delpo at the end of next year. I have real questions about Murray.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, you've still got Murray, you've still got Djokovic, you've still got Kevin Anderson.
Yeah, but see, like, I have real questions about Murray and whether or not he'll ever get back to being a top 3, top 4 guy. I have real questions about that just because of the nature of his injury. And then, you know, the thing to me also is, honestly, like, if Goffin comes out and plays the way that we're starting to see and keeps doing the work that we've seen him doing, like, I think he has the potential to go out there and beat Murray and be a better player than Murray at this point in his career.
Yeah,
No doubt about it.
And then, you know, I mean, we forget about, like, Milos Raonic was 3 in the world. He's split up with his longtime coach so that he can get back on track because he's down at 24. But, I mean, it's just if Goffin and Grigor are able to stay in that top 5, I mean, you're ahead of guys that have been in the top 10 for, like, most of their career. Like, I mean, you're doing it in the hardest era that we've seen in a very long time. Like, it's...
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
Your level has to be super high.
I'm going to say real quick, I don't see Raonic ever being a top 5 guy again. I think he's already hit his peak, career peak. I don't think he's going to get back up there. And, you know, I mean, I'd be really curious to see what Nick Kyrgios does. But again, I think we're starting to get into a whole other podcast territory. Those of you who saw the match, you know, if you have any thoughts that you want to share or talk about, think we're wrong, think we're right, shoot us an email, reach out to us. I think you can actually tweet at us too now.
you can tweet at Tactical Tennis, although it's not super active yet, and you can find us also at Tactical Tennis on Instagram, which is more
yes often. that is active now. You know, but if you want to tweet to me specifically, I am at Glenn S. Hill, and
my Twitter handle is at Jacob Tweet. You can also just tweet at Tactical Tennis, either one. You can email me at jacob@tacticaltennis.com.
And I'm Glenn with one N at tacticaltennis.com. And, you know, love to hear from you folks. If you have something, you know, we've got this little off period here. Obviously, professional tennis is done for 2017.
That's almost true.
Well, I mean, I'm not counting Davis Cup. Davis Cup is you know, separate.
Did you
universe.
Hear what Jack Sock said about Davis Cup?
I did
they,
not.
They asked him, like, you know, his thoughts on the final coming up next week and stuff, and he was just completely dismissive. He was like, I mean, I'm not going to follow any of it. I really don't care. I don't know what you're telling me. Like, he completely dismissed it. Like, it was...
Nice.
It actually was a little bit discouraging. Like, that's not maybe the way that I... want, you know, a guy who just cracked the top 10 to talk about, you know.
Highest ranked American, and you're American. That can't make you feel
no,
so happy.
I gotta imagine, I really think that most of American tennis players, And frankly, I mean, I've asked American tennis players about this, and to a T, they all disagree with the way that Jack answers that question, and answers a lot of questions. So,
yeah, well, that's fair enough. Yeah, so anyways, we do have this period here. So if there's stuff that you would like us to talk about, this is a great time. You can you know, reach out to us and bring up a specific topic, and I'm sure we'd be happy to tackle it. So on that note, folks, have a good night. Have a happy Thanksgiving. And for those of you who are in America and for those of you who aren't, have a happy Thursday. And we'll catch up with you soon.
Be grateful for something.